Croydon thing that's been going on Twitter? What's that? What is that? What is the Croydon thing?
So we did a... So John and I did a series of gigs. Not last year, but the year before already.
Oh, God.
In Croydon.
We did a series of gigs called Croydon Till I Die. with fellow Croydon residents, Lucy Mangan came and did one, and Bob Stanley.
You don't live in Croydon, or did you used to live in Croydon?
Yeah, I grew up near Croydon.
Oh, he's got a tattoo to prove
it. I went to Croydon every Saturday afternoon from the years 1973 to 1985.
The only thing I know about Croydon is the population is the same as Iceland.
Yes,
it is. 325,000.
John, tell John about our triumphant homecoming gig.
Well, we did a show at Croydon Fairfield Halls, which, you know, is... You
famous
know,
place.
Yeah, it's
presumably,
a fantastic...
You know,
well, it is. And also,
only place
you know,
I've ever played my mum was impressed with, I tell you.
And, loads of bands, loads of really famous bands like Kraftwerk and Sparks and people have played there over the years. So it's, you know... It's
and Captain Sensible was...
Yeah, well, he was...
He cleaned the toilet.
The toilet attendant.
Yes, that's right, yes.
Good music treasure, Max. Great.
And, so we got to play this kind of, 350 people. And
yeah,
they had to bring loads of extra chairs in, didn't they? It's amazing.
We played the Arnhem Gallery in the Fairfield Halls. And when we arrived, the steward said, yes, we're expecting about, 30 or 40, and we're going to move you into a smaller room. And so John and Bob went to the bar to go, never mind, we'll put everyone down the front. And then when they opened the doors, 350 people came in, including my Auntie Linda, who I deliberately hadn't told about the gig.
It's like the producers.
Yeah, it was amazing.
They liked it.
Yeah, or it was like a scene from Ben-Hur. It just felt like all these extras just kept flooding in all the time. It's like, oh my God, there's more people than the room can hold. What's going
Hashtag
on?
Famous in Croydon.
It was very
we'll
exciting.
We'll have wine, women and song, and women. Not favourite line from the producers.
It's one of the best nights of my life.
Oh, it was a brilliant, that was an amazing night. Amazing.
Well, it's very exciting.
How was Christmas?
It was brilliant. My time zones were a week in New Zealand.
Oh, you were in New Zealand?
Strange.
Yes.
No, I wasn't in New Zealand for Christmas. I came back on 23rd, so I was a bit topsy-turvy, but it's brilliant for reading. Plane travel is, I almost think I should just, every month I should go on a very, very long, because there's nothing, there is literally nothing else to do. You think, I'll watch some of the in-flight movies. And
yeah.
One good film, Captain Fantastic. And the rest of it was, I could have watched the whole of Lord of the Rings again, I could have watched the whole of The Hobbit again, although why would you? Well, weirdly, my brother was in it, which is quite amusing. At one point, I was sitting next to a Japanese girl, and I said, that's my brother in there, just there. And she looked and looked again. She said, incredible! I said, yeah.
What part did your brother play?
He
Third orc from the left.
He had a few lines. They weren't terribly good lines, like, they're over there, or this way. But he was called Braga. Not only did he have a named character, but he also had a Lego model. So, While I was in New Zealand, he got a royalty check. And he's actually, weirdly, he's become addicted to backlisted. It's rather touching.
Oh, that's nice. Hello, Braga.
Yeah, but he got a royalty check from the US for the merchandise rights alone of $3,000.
Do you want that?
Can you imagine what Ian McKellen and
I once did some work, animated some Lego figures for a thing that when I was working at The Guardian. And so I was in contact with the people at Lego. Do you want to know the best thing about working at Lego?
Go on.
Is they don't give you a business card. They give you a little minifig like you with your name printed on the front and your phone number on the front of the... it'd be worth working at Lego just for that, wouldn't it?
Some of us have done that ourselves.
I tweeted that I was... I booked a mini break in Mordor because the exchange rate was better than the EU. Did anybody have any tips? And Matthew came back and said, you probably ought to ring ahead. It's quite a good thread, that.
Yeah, I did see it.
Amusing,
yes. Shall we start then?
Why don't we?
Hello and welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. If this is the first time you're listening to us in 2017, then Happy New Year. You join us once more gathered around the kitchen table in the stripped-back, Scandi-vibed Islington Canalside office of our sponsors Unbound, the website which brings authors and readers together to make great books. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound.
And I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. Happy New Year, everyone. And joining us today is John Grindrod, Croydon's John Grindrod.
Happy New Year.
Author of Concretopia, a book about the modernist rebuilding of post-war Britain and its associated blog, Dirty Modern Scoundrel. He's most definitely not the John Grindrod who was the Bishop of Brisbane from 1980 to 1989, who was the last Englishman to be elected Primate of Australia.
Although if you do a Google search, quite often his biography comes up with my picture.
Our John Grindrod, however, does have a new book coming out in May, I believe. Is that right?
That is true.
Called Outskirts, which is being published by Sceptre. What is that book about? Like, I don't know.
So that book, Andy, thank you for asking, is the story of how the Greenbelts came into being. So from the kind of Victorian ideas of kind of the countryside and the sprawling of towns and how cities were sort of seen as evil pits of sin, right through to the kind of 1930s and 50s when they started to be sort of become an actual policy by the government, and then to now where they're all sort of falling to bits.
We as Croydon dwellers.
Yes.
And me specifically as a Coolsden dweller. We live near Farthing Downs, mm-hmm. which was a lovely little bit of green belt. Mm. Unspoilt greenbelt land. I don't even know if that's still there or whether that's been...
No, I grew up opposite the greenbelt as well, right on the edge of New Addington outside Croydon. So a lot of the book is actually a sort of family story about my family's inability to kind of quite navigate living on the edge of the countryside or integrate with the housing estate that we lived on. So there's a lot of that in it as well.
We're both very pro-suburban, you can tell.
Yeah, well, it's where all the action happens, obviously. Yeah. Edgelands, do you know that?
Yes,
that
yeah, it's a lovely book.
Yeah. Excellent, good to have more about Croydon on there. But the book that John is here to talk about is not his own, it's Memento Mori by Muriel Spark. But actually, before we get on to that, a little bit of housekeeping. Imagine our surprise, listeners, when listening to one of our favourite podcasts, the New York Times Book Review, we got... as I think they call it, Andy, a shout-out.
That's what I'm told.
From John Williams, the New York Times Daily Books editor. Would you like to hear what he said?
I'd love to.
Even though I'm on a podcast every week, or mostly weeks, I don't really listen to many podcasts, but one that I do is this British podcast called Backlisted, and it's sort of a book club where it's about an hour long and they choose a book based on a guest who recommends it, and then they sit around and talk about it and read passages from it, and it's all very elegant and charming in that British way and very smart. And they recently did one of my favorite books, which Greg had talked about earlier this year, called So Long, See You Tomorrow, a brief novel by William Maxwell. And so their enthusiasm for it sent me back to it, and it's short, so that's nice. And I reread that, which is just – it's one of only like a handful of books that I would say is maybe perfect.
So, John Williams, that is. Thank you very much.
Yes,
that.
Thanks, John.
Much
thanks,
appreciated in our charming, kind of, you know, understated British way. We're
thanks very much.
We're really pleased. But now, Andy, can you tell us in that elegant, charming way that you have what you've been reading?
So, to slightly change the tone of what we've been talking about, we've all just come back from Christmas, and I'm sorry to report, many of the people listening to this will be aware of this, that our friend, the agent, literary agent and writer, David Miller, passed away over Christmas. And I was a friend of David's. I saw him probably about, 6 weeks ago. He was on terrific form. He was then, as I'm sure he will be remembered, an enthusiast. David's enthusiasm for his authors and for writing in general, your phone would ring, you go, yes, who is it? And he'd go, Miller. And you say, how are you, David? Sickeningly well. And then he'd just read to you whatever he happened to be enthused about at the time, be it one of his authors or be it he loved Anita Bruckner, he loved Shirley Hazzard, he loved Muriel Spark. In fact,
he did.
And one of the other projects that David worked on, which we're going to talk about briefly, was a fantastic collection of 100 short stories called That Glimpse of Truth. And David wrote a little introduction to every story that he included in that volume. And the volume is one of those volumes of short stories where the ones you know are the right ones, and the ones you don't know are usually terrific. So you look for The Nose by Gogol, and it's in here. You look for Sredni Vashtar by Saki, it's in here. You look for In Dreams Begin Responsibilities by Delmore Schwartz, that's in here. But there's all sorts of other interesting and stranger things. And there's also an index as well, but it isn't an index. It's J.G. Ballard's story, The Index, which takes the form of an index. But this is what David wrote about Muriel Spark. He said, Muriel Spark, 1918 to 2006, was the author of several novels, including The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. It should be noted that whole novel was published by The New Yorker before volume publication. Her finest fiction was short. The Driver's Seat is a model of sheer genius, which I read, like Melville's Bartleby, each year. Yeah. And that made me think of William Maxwell twice, because first of all, So Long, See You Tomorrow was published in its entirety in The New Yorker, and second of all, if people listen to the Maxwell episode a few weeks ago, you'll remember that William Maxwell said he wasn't frightened of death. He was just sorry he wouldn't be able to read any more novels. Which I think... perhaps David, at some level, would have agreed with. John, did you know David?
I knew him. I mean, really, not as a close friend, but as somebody who I always immensely look forward to seeing. He had that capacity to as you say, the capacity to enthuse you on anything that he was representing, but also just on literature in general. He was, I mean, you know, when people talk about being well read, I mean, David had read everything. He was remarkable. I mean, you could talk to him. Literally pick an author out of the sky and he would have an opinion, and usually a well-informed opinion. he laughs nervously. Yeah. But I just think wonderful sitting in his office listening to a talk. He always had wonderful music playing. He was great, you know, brilliant at music. He was generous. He was funny. He was waspish. He was kind of, in a way, concentrated. When you think of the old school values of publishing,
that's,
you know,
so that, true. That
he was like a character from a Muriel Spark novel in a way. He was so well drawn. He was so, you know, his insights were always so good, and he was also funny. You know, just used to make you roar with laughter. Yeah, I mean, Frankfurt with David, anywhere you went, you know, he was obviously enjoyed. He enjoyed being the person who would meet, you know, he'd introduce you to somebody else or drop you into the middle of a situation. He'd play pranks on you. But I just remember when we started Unbound, you know, there was a lot of agents were sceptical, but he was fantastically supportive. Had us into the Rogers Coleridge and White office, you know, talked to us about books, and I think we did in the end. We ended up doing through him and Peter Strauss the Gautam Malkani book. And what I'd been reading, I hadn't read his novel, which I'd always meant to read today.
One of those kind of
is a remarkable book. He called it his dead dad book because, I mean, in some strange way, that book has mirrored his own life. His father died suddenly, and he found that it was a tremendous blow to him. And this book is about the sudden death of Joseph Conrad, the author.
I was, you know, kind of watching a lot of Alan Bennett monologues. We would love to, and it just kind of felt like it was.
He was on our long list of people to have him to. And the book is
an extension of that, I think,
short novel.
Mindset, really.
Again, in that vein, the Maxwell vein, perfect economy.
One of the things I really,
in a way, I read it with massive sadness because
I found it incredibly moving.
It's because he's particularly. About that Conrad leaves two sons behind. The effect of sudden death and of grief and how it transfigures families.
And I found that kind of weird, even though it's got so many kind of quite negative things in it. It is an amazing portrait of being old and vital and unlikely.
But the fact that he was able to write about it so
when did she write it?
She was 40 with no sentimentality at all. It's a very unsentimental book, albeit as
she
you
didn't
say,
start. It's
called Today.
It's an interesting book. The Comforters,
he started
which is
writing a second
a novel
novel
about a
that's the
weird
thing you
experience.
Feel,
you know,
had.
You wanted you, when she, you felt there was more
to say about Muriel Spark.
They got rid.
He said it was
my dead dad.
Very, very hard.
Got rid a long time at doing a series.
The Today is based on a Conrad story called Tomorrow, and there's a quote from the.
And she got ill because she didn't eat enough.
David put,
she was poor.
I think
and then she was also taking dexedrine.
in the bush
this
somewhere.
This made her
in the
have
sea,
hallucinations.
On a blamed mountaintop for choice. At home, yes.
Where she felt
the
that
world's
the whole of
my
T.S. Eliot. There was some
but
strange
I expect I'll die in a hospital.
The whole of T.S. Eliot's
what
poetry.
Of it?
Any so the
place
first
is
book
enough,
is about somebody
as long
who
as
suffers
I've lived.
From this strange delusion, and it got brilliant reviews.
Wonderful.
She does another kind of adventure novel called Robinson,
which
and then she writes Memento Mori, which I think most people feel is the first
David Miller in it.
Brilliant.
Yeah,
not going to be the
same. It really is. It's,
and she's
it's,
also, she converts,
the number of people
she,
that you see
Roman Catholicism.
You breeze into a party.
Yeah. Prior to writing this book,
53.
Saw David
and she is sponsored, if that's the right word,
because you knew
by Evelyn Waugh and Graham Greene. And Graham Greene supported her in the writing of Memento Mori. He said, as long as she promised never ever to pray for him.
He used to do this. I read, which is I recommend any Spark fans
to
do.
In the introduction
fans,
to his stories,
I'm
just going to quote
a Spark fan.
Yeah. He says here,
necessarily a Spark fan.
I hope the stories collected here reflect what writing is about, life and its complications.
Which roundly upbraided.
And then a bit further on the
show, George Morley,
women
on Twitter.
Yes,
fine, upstanding women on Twitter. Quite right too, but I'm totally addicted now. I think I said to you guys, it's like literary crack. I'm actually having to. I've done four, and I have to slow down because I've worked out. I don't want to have a year where I don't have a new Muriel Spark to read.
One Christmas holiday.
This is a very this is
one Christmas holiday.
After he
just won the 1982 Nobel Prize for literature,
send to her
when I was nearly 17 and
but in order to make it feel less kind of.
I asked my mother if she could buy anything by Gabriel Garcia Marquez,
which I've also read.
And she came back
from
the WH
a case of wine as well, so somehow it made it feel less like charity.
So so John, what is the premise? John Grinrub, what is the premise of this book? Before I read the blurb, what happens at the beginning of the book?
So at the beginning of the book, Dame Letty Coulson, who is the daughter of a brewery magnate, and a penal reformer, grandee. She is writing a letter and she gets interrupted by a phone call, and the caller, who was called before, says, "Remember, you must die." And she's driven into a kind of state of great agitation about this. And her brother, Godfrey, reluctantly takes her in because she's a bit of a nightmare. He's also a bit of a nightmare. He is one of the great mansplainers of fiction. He spends most of the novel telling women who are 12 times more intelligent than he is things that they wouldn't even bother thinking about. And his wife, who is infirm and is kind of slowly kind of losing her marbles, is this wonderful romantic novelist called Charmian Coulson. And they take in Dame Letty at the beginning of the book.
That's right.
And then it's sort of this awful scenario then where she doesn't want to stay with them. Everyone's resentful of everyone else.
You should say two things that are really remarkable about this novel. It is a novel, with one exception, that is entirely populated with people who are over 70 or I mean, that is in itself, when you're reading it, you think, my God, I haven't read The Old Devils by Kingsley Amis, but I can't think of a book where old characters have been like young.
Yeah.
And the second thing is, there's no settled. You're in lots of different heads. It's third person.
That's right.
And I think that's my theory about why this book is perhaps less popular than some of the others with some readers who find it cold and mean, is that you don't have a Mrs. Hawkins. You do in Far Cry from Kensington, who you're rooting for.
Yeah.
That you think, God, what a ghast. I mean, pretty much everybody's compromised.
I mean, that's what I haven't read any Muriel Sparks other than this book, but but on reading it, I thought at the end of it, the only two characters that are remotely engaging or pleasant, two Catholics. I don't think there's any coincidence
and
in that.
Also, the thing I love about the book is that Dame Muriel.
And they're both converts as well. Sorry.
Yes, they're converts. Dame Muriel. So everyone who hears the voice saying "Remember, you must die" hears a different voice,
which is
near the end. She just says, "Oh, I think it was death," or something like that. Yeah. There's no attempt to explain the plot.
It's what's the name?
Miss Taylor. But then also the policeman.
The policeman does.
They both kind of come up with this idea sort of separately. But one of the things I love about Muriel Spark novels is that she quite often is quite happy for you not to not to explain people's behaviour, and also I think from her point of view, not to necessarily understand it herself. And I've always felt like I don't really understand other people particularly well, and as a reader I find that incredibly satisfying in her books, that there are no kind of pat explanations of why people are behaving like they also, are, why they're so deluded, why they live in these bizarre worlds.
Also, she's a great writer for telling... I love writers who turn to the reader at some point and either say or imply, this is only a book.
Yeah.
We're only reading... You're only reading a book. This isn't, and therefore I can do what I want.
She doesn't do this in... So much in Memento Mori, but the turning to the reader in Far Cry from Kensington.
Yeah, yes. We'll read
it. I mean, Rachel was bored by it. She said, I want to read this book. I don't want you to. I've got to listen to this. This is so good. But I was just saying, this book, Memento Mori, is, I mean, it's mad, okay? It is, on one side, it is a meditation on the impossibility of death in the mind of the living.
Yeah.
And at the other time, it's an Agatha Christie novel.
Yeah, it is.
Which is about, because it's got everything. It's got murder with the lead, I think I'm allowed to say, it's got murder with the lead piping, but it's also got this brilliant device, the phone call. It's such a brilliant, remember you must die, and then gradually more and more of the characters. And you don't know whether it's are the characters doing it to one another? Or is it a kind of hallucinatory hearing voices, which...
A kind of mass psychosis.
Muriel, as we know, had...
I was going to ask, had she laid off the blues at this point, or was she still kind of strung out on amphetamine?
She was not strung out on amphetamine.
Shall I just read the blurb on the back of this Penguin edition, and then we'll ask John to read... John Grinrod to read a little bit to us. So the blurb says, Dame Letty Colston, 79 and pioneer penal reformer, has much in common with the elderly residents of the Maud Long Medical Ward. Oh, that's a grim scene. All are united by scorn, resentment, boredom, and the humour that masks the awareness of impending death. Then the insidious telephone calls begin. Remember, you must die, intones the grave, anonymous voice. As the suspicious recipients set out to unravel the macabre mystery and catch the culprit before the culprit catches them, the intrigues, duplicities and tragedies of their lives, past and present, come to light in Muriel Spark's immortally funny parable of life and death. Says Evelyn Waugh, a brilliant and singularly gruesome achievement. And he wrote The Loved One, so he should know. I read this and A Far Cry from Kensington and The Driver's Seat and The Abbess of Crewe. Have you read it?
Amazing. Oh, it's what? Completely amazing.
How best to explore the subject of the Watergate scandal than by setting it in a convent with a load of nuns? Oh. one of whom is a Nixon surrogate, one of whom is a Kissinger surrogate.
I have to say, Andy, you've had a bit of a nuntastic year, haven't you?
I have.
None
but the brave.
I have none better.
You did the Golding one.
I did The Spire by William Golding, and I did Corner that Held Them by Sylvia Townsend Warner, which is almost my favourite book of last year. But my feeling, having read several novels by Muriel Spark, thank you, John, now, is that like Barbara Cummings or William Maxwell, your appreciation of each book that you read deepens with every successive one that you read, right? And Spark is both I find her quite demanding as a novelist, but not as a prose stylist.
No.
So in the case of Memento Mori, you're expected to take on board like this massive cast of characters and to pay attention, but there's one beautifully constructed sentence after another to get you there.
She's unbelievable. I mean, I would definitely say now, having read four, that I probably wouldn't start with Memento Mori, because when I went back, I read it first and was like, whoa.
Well, it's really full on, isn't it?
And then I read three more, and I've gone back to go through the book, and I realised it really, really helps to have read more Muriel Spark, because you realise what a remarkable thing to do for your third novel. Yeah. I mean, she is this... You know, we were talking about Jane Gardam just went upstairs.
Yes,
it's a bit
yes.
like that. She always said, in Curriculum Vitae, she says she thinks of herself as predominantly a poet. Okay?
Yeah.
So... she likes short stories. You know, this is actually, I think, maybe her longest novel. Mm. I don't know. It's certainly one of the longest.
Yeah.
And it's only, what, just, barely just 200, over 200, just over 200 pages. Yeah.
John G., will you read
this? Read some from Memento Mori.
Can I read? Yes, okay. So this is from the first chapter, not quite the beginning. This is sort of following on from the setup that I said earlier. Did you have a nice evening at the pictures, Taylor? Said Charmian. I am not Taylor, said Dame Letty. And in any case, you always called Taylor Jean during her last 20 or so years in your service. Mrs. Anthony, their daily housekeeper, brought in the milky coffee and placed it on the breakfast table. Did you have a nice evening at the pictures, Taylor? Charmian asked her. Yes, thanks, Mrs. Colston, said the housekeeper. Mrs. Anthony is not Taylor, said Letty. There is no one by the name of Taylor here. And anyway, you used to call her Jean latterly. It was only when you were a girl that you called Taylor Taylor. And in any event, Mrs. Anthony is not Taylor. Godfrey came in. He kissed Charmian. She said, good morning, Eric. He is not Eric, said Dame Letty. Godfrey frowned at his sister. Her resemblance to himself irritated him. He opened the Times. Are there lots of obituaries today? Said Charmian. Oh, don't be gruesome, said Letty. Would you like me to read you the obituaries, dear? Godfrey said, turning the pages to find the place in defiance of his sister. Well, I should like the war news, Charmian said. The war has been over since 1945, Dame Letty said, if indeed it is the last war to which you were referring. Perhaps, however, you meant the First World War, the Crimean, perhaps. Letty, please, said Godfrey. He noted that Letty's hand was unsteady as she raised her cup, and the twitch on her left cheek was pronounced. He thought in how much better form he himself was than his sister, though she was the younger, only 79. Mrs. Anthony looked round the door. Someone on the phone for Dame Letty. Oh, who is it? Wouldn't give a name. Ask who it is, please. Did ask. Wouldn't give. I'll go, said Godfrey. Dame Letty followed him to the telephone and overheard the male voice. Tell Dame Letty, it said, to remember she must die. Who's there? Said Godfrey, but the man had hung up. We must have been followed, said Letty. I told no one I was coming over here last night. She telephoned to report the occurrence to the assistant inspector. He said, are you sure you didn't mention to anyone that you intended to stay at your brother's home? Of course I'm sure. Your brother actually heard the voice, heard it himself. Yes, as I say, he took the call. She told Godfrey, I'm glad you took the call. It corroborates my story. I've just realised that the police have been doubting it. Doubting your word? Well, I suppose they thought I might have imagined it. Now perhaps they will be more active. Charmian says, the police? What are you saying about the police? Have we been robbed? I am being molested, said Dame Letty. Mrs. Anthony came in to clear the table. Ah, Taylor, how old are you? Said Charmian. 69, Mrs. Colston, said Mrs. Anthony. When will you be 70? 28th of November. That will be splendid, Taylor. You will then be one of us, said Charmian.
Very good, thank you.
Brilliant. I've got a review here that I found of Memento Mori by Mr. L.R. Davis that was posted on Amazon on the 24th of September 2010. 4 stars, Miss Spark's little gem of a read. I have read Memento Mori twice. The first time was in the 60s, my late 20s. The second, recently, I'm approaching 80, rapidly. Age has taught me a lot, and I can now appreciate Memento Mori a great deal more than I once did. All book lovers should read it. It is a remarkable work of very considerable merit. Muriel Spark is a fine writer. In Memento Mori, she does not suffer the lazy reader. Does not suffer the lazy reader is my all-time new favourite phrase. The main characters, quite a few, hear the imperative and experience the inevitable. Plot and subplot hold the reader, and the careful ones will grasp connections missed by inattention. If you are a stranger to Muriel Spark, catch up on what you have missed. Good reading, Lionel.
Good old Lionel.
Good old Lionel.
Why only 4 stars?
Can I read a small passage? Which this is one of those things where you know the books that there are moments in books where you think she's actually doing this. She's actually pushing it. I'll give you one. Just this brilliant, very short sentence. This is perfect Muriel Spark sentence. Okay, there were 12 occupants of the Maud Long Medical Ward. Open brackets. Aged people, female. The ward sister called them the baker's dozen, not knowing that this is 13, but having only heard the phrase, and thus it is that a good many old sayings lose their force. It's like that brilliant thing of giving you a lesson while moving the story along. But listen to this. This is a brilliant thing. This involves Godfrey and the fearsome Mrs. Pettigrew. On the first occasion, it had been necessary for him to indicate his requirements to her. But now she perfectly understood.
Godfrey, with his thin face outstanding in the dim lamplight and his excited eyes, placed on the low coffee table a pound note. And then he stood, arms dangling and legs apart, like a stage rustic watching her. Without shifting her posture, she raised the hem of her skirt at one side until the top of her stocking and the tip of her suspender were visible. Then she went on knitting and watching the television screen. Godfrey gazed at the stocking top and the glittering steel of the suspender tip for the space of 2 minutes' silence. Then he pulled back his shoulders, as if recalling his propriety, and still in silence, walked out. After the first occasion, Mrs. Pettigrew had imagined, almost with alarm, almost with alarm, that his request was merely the preliminary to more daring explorations on his part. But by now she knew, with an old woman's relief, that this was all he would ever desire, the top of her stocking and the tip of her suspender. She took the pound note off the table, put it in her black suede handbag and loosened her stays. She had plans for the future. Meantime, a pound was a pound.
So, John, you were giving us some of the biography there. Yeah. We were talking about Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. That was her sixth novel.
Yeah.
Massively successful all over the world. In total, she wrote 22 novels, the last of which was The Finishing School in 2004. She was twice shortlisted for the Booker for Loitering in Intent in 1981, which is another publishing book which I very much want to read, and in 1968 for The Public Image, the title of which inspired John Lydon's post-Sex Pistols group.
No.
True? Absolutely that true. So no, cool. That's that, true.
There's our tenuous link, everybody. Yep. Muriel Spark and the Sex Pistols.
She also wrote poetry, essays, short stories, many of which were ghost stories.
She was always winning prizes.
Volume of autobiography, curriculum vitae, which she mentioned. She edited selections of letters by Emily Bronte, Mary Shelley, John Henry Newman, and she wrote a biography of John Masefield. And she also wrote a children's book called The Very Fine Clock, which was illustrated by Edward Gorey. OBE in 1967, Made a Dame in 1993. She wrote all her books in copperplate handwriting, straight in a single draft, into special spiral-bound notebooks imported from Edinburgh stationer's James Thin, using only one side of the paper. Did you know that?
Incredible.
Jeez. What, never went back and edited in one draft?
Apparently not. Would try and stick as closely as possible to the first.
Wow.
Which is incredible, attempt. Given her kind of, you know, the brevity of those sentences and the way that she's able to communicate things so elegantly, and also the structure of...
Yeah.
All of the books of hers that I've read, and I've read quite a few of them, that the structure is incredible in each of them. And I think there are lots of reasons why I like different novelists. You know, I like one for, you know, the amazing characterization, another one for kind of, you know, fantastic plots or whatever. I think she's got everything going on. There's a beautiful writing style, incredible characters, amazing dialogue, yeah. Brilliant plot. You know, there's
did,
all
did
of
she
that
plot
stuff.
It out? I mean, from that. It's not clear.
She tended no. We I think she tended to make it up as she was going along. That's one of the other things that she would see where the story would take her.
I mean, she kept notebooks. She was a massive hoarder, and she was in a way she's also an incredible control freak. So one of the things you get curriculum vitae is that a lot of the book is spent settling scores. Really,
people including with her own son,
that she feel that she's yeah. been that she'd been misinterpreted, that details of her life had been misinterpreted, and she, you know, there was a certain amount of, there was a poor man called Derek Stanford who wrote an early account of her life who becomes Hector Bartlett in Far Cry from Kensington. But can I give you just this for a put down from curriculum vitae? When she was Poetry Society president, she was very unpopular for backing the moderns, and it went, I mean, as only kind of the world of poetry can be, it got incredibly vituperative. So this is her account of one of her critics. One enraged reader who joined in the campaign of harassment against me was Dr. Mary Stopes, the famous birth control expert. On that account, much to be admired. She was absolutely opposed to my idea of poetry. Up to his death 3 years earlier, she'd been living with Lord Alfred Douglas, the fatal lover of Oscar Wilde, an arrangement which I imagine would satisfy any woman's craving for birth control. I met her at one of our meetings and knew she disliked me intensely on sight. I was young and pretty, and she had totally succumbed to the law of gravity without attempting to do a thing about it.
We normally on Backlisted we have a clip of our author talking.
Where possible.
Where possible. That hasn't been possible, but there is a fantastic episode of A Good Read from 2004, which you can download for free from iTunes, with Dame Muriel talking about The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie to James Naughty, which is terrific. I just want to...
So can I just say, that vituperativeness and the fact that she was a member of the Poetry Society makes me wonder which poet she based the green-fanged, slightly malevolent poet in Mentor Mori on.
Yeah, I don't
who
know.
Who's absolutely fantastic.
Interestingly, the only person that she ever sort of said, she says that dealing with her grandmother when she was a child, 12 years old, having to hump her grandmother in and out of bed or carry her gently, she loved her grandmother, and the amazing details of her grandmother. Most of the book is about incredibly detailed childhood memories of dresses. I mean, she didn't become an academic because she thought they were all rather dull, and she liked charming clothes. And there was always that sort of, you know, that thing. But I think it could be any one of the one who was the defending Percy Mannering, the one who's defending Ernest Dowson.
And the whole kind of Percy Mannering and Guy Leet, who's the kind of, you know, the
hunched over
the
two sticks
from the party, is kind of wandering over the two sticks, and they have an amazing physical fight at the end of the book.
That's right.
And then and they're having a fight over a review of a book that one of them's done, and they, you know, clearly all of this kind of passion and hatred, and then they end up sort of staying together for 3 weeks after that. And they're talking about poetry. And you know, that kind of passion that they've got for what they're doing.
There's a fantastic bit as well where he sends a telegram that runs to about 5 pages.
Yes. Are you sure you want to send all this?
Yes, I do.
There's a character in... we keep talking about... I always meant to read A Far Cry from Kensington when I worked in Kensington, but I never did. I'm just going to read a little bit here, which anyone who's spent any time in bookselling or publishing will recognise the truth of this. He's a large publisher called McIntosh and Tooley, the narrator. She says, "I remember random scenes, and I also remember my subsequent memories, so that I recall that I was lying awake in the dark about 10 years ago, when to my mind came the image of a meeting and I had had in my office at McIntosh and Tooley with a young man, one of the most beautiful I have ever seen, the author of a large novel about nothing in particular. It proved only that he passionately wanted to write. And I told him we couldn't take the book, but he should try another, more concise, not so long and rambling, and about something in particular. I recall very little else of that interview, but that he embarked on a lengthy discourse citing famous long novels about nothing in particular. Had I read Finnegan's Wake?
Yay!
I had to admit I hadn't, not from cover to cover.
I
didn't know at the time that very few people had. He spoke for an hour. He accepted my coffee and biscuits and went on talking. I wish I could remember more of what he said. It was extremely above my head. Had I read Buddenbrooks by Thomas Mann? I hadn't, but I had heard of it. I evaded the question by taking a chance. But that is about something in particular. He said it contained nothing but details and went on. Had I read Proust? Yes, I had read Proust. And you say it's about something in particular? Well, my novel is about everything in particular. So it is, I said, but it isn't Proust. So you're looking for another Proust, he said. One isn't enough. I forget how I got him out of the office. I only remember his going.
I mean, you have to say that there's a great thing that A.L. Kennedy says in the introduction to this, which I think it sums up. I mean, Sparks' work delights in mentioning the unmentionable. That nice people think nasty thoughts and do nasty things. That dressed people can also be naked. That sex is rarely as elevated or romantic as we'd wish. That the idea of strangers or old people or ugly people having sex can be appalling. That forgetting death renders us foolish, and that dying can make us seem more foolish still. The eccentric joy and energy of this novel, what may be the rush of the author's enthusiasms, her mature passions, is part of what makes a book on an unsupportable subject not just philosophically stimulating, but also delightful. It's a really nice kind of way of... I mean, she's such an interesting novelist. I mean, this book is a really interesting book. It really is an interesting meditation on the how death functions. But she has this way. There's a great line another contemporary writer had, which I love. Ali Smith, her whole work is a sprightly philosophical rejection of 20th century angst, one of the great things about this podcast, reading women writers of the 20th century, I do wonder whether I've spent a lot of my time just reading a lot of very self-indulgent men.
You know,
because
what?
These novels are not, they're not light social novels. These are really, this is a proper complex, but done with such, I mean, you know, reading the first few pages of Far Cry from Kensington, if you can't read that and want to read on, it's the way she puts big philosophical themes down with a lightness of touch, mm-hmm. and then creates these characters, and also amazing resolution
G, did you find her funny when you first read
yes.
her?
And that was one of the great appeals, actually, was how funny I found her. And also, one of the other things I really loved about her was that she would incorporate elements of other sorts of books that I really love, so like murder mystery, or particularly a kind of supernatural element.
Yeah, ghost
often
stories, aren't they?
Crops up, like the Ballad of Peckham Rye, where the devil, you know, joins a company in Peckham as, you know, as the HR guy. I mean, if that isn't the best premise for a novel ever, I don't know what it is. And
there's a film of the driver's seat.
Yeah,
and there's a film,
which I've not seen.
And there's a film of the Abbess of Crewe called Dirty Habits.
Is there?
Yeah. Brilliant. And there's a film of Memento Mori.
Is there?
A TV film that was made by the director Jack Clayton, who in the 60s made The Innocents and Our Mother's House, and an adaptation of Penelope Mortimer's novel The Pumpkin Eater. And it's who's in it? It's amazing.
It's amazing. So Michael Horden plays Godfrey. Maggie Smith plays Mrs. Pettigrew. Dame Letty is Stephanie Cole. But Charmian is played by Rennie Asherton, who is absolutely heartbreakingly wonderful in it. You kind of can't stop looking at her. But basically, every single role in it is portrayed by some incredible, like, actor you've watched all your life. And I think one of the things that that he also did was, I think he only employed a really elderly crew to work on it.
Yeah.
So the editors, true, the camera people, everybody were, you know, they'd all kind of worked on each other's their whole lives.
He made it for TV in the early 90s, and he'd wanted to make it since 1959.
Amazing.
But he had access to the rights and held on to it until he was
it
old
available?
Enough. No,
it's not, which is a real shame. It's completely brilliant. I had it on video, and now I don't have a video, or in fact a tape, which is a real shame, but I did watch it so much because I loved it. And it's interesting, there were a few structural changes to that happened in it. So it's made much more of a murder mystery by moving the revelation until the very end that it is death that is phoning them all up.
Right.
Eric is in it a lot more.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Well, there we are. We have said that already.
We have, to be fair.
Yeah. And, you know, there are kind of quite a few things like that. There's also the resolution is kind of much softer than it is in the book. But one of the things I think that is so wonderful about the book is the very last kind of third of it becomes a much more kind of philosophical and meditative thing. And all of the characters, it feels like they kind of break through this kind of very brittle wall that they have of their own understanding of death and life. And they all start
even
thinking
Godfrey.
More profoundly. I know, even Godfrey, who is the most infuriating character because he's...
It's that thing about him splitting matches in half.
Yeah.
So he doubles the number of... He sits with relish drinking a scotch and soda with a razor blade, splitting the matches in half so he has twice the number of matches.
I also loved how Muriel Spark, who's, you know, is a very literary writer with a very clever, clear understanding of the heritage of the British-American and American novel, plays a joke with you in the last two pages of this book by, instead of doing what Dickens would have done, which is tell you little life stories of what happened to all the characters you've been reading about, she tells you how all the characters die one by one at the end of the book. You know, they don't live happily ever after.
And you've got to say that I think my favourite character, I'm not going to read anymore, but it's the gerontologist, what's his name, Alec?
Oh, yeah, Alec, yeah.
Yeah, who is like, it's like Casormon, this ridiculous kind
that's
of...
That's right!
You know, and it's all these wonderful things. Could you also write down your temperature? I know this must be a shock for you, but do you think you could take all these details down? So, and he has this amazing card file.
Yeah.
It's the kind of the futility of scholarship.
Everybody has got their own way of trying to kind of cope with life and death in the book, and his way is so banal. the way that the details that he's collecting are so useless.
I think, though, I would say it's foolproof. It's foolproof spark, and if people want to, I would start, if you start with Girl of Slender Means or Far Cry, which are slightly later novels, I think I think it's a as I say, I went back to it and enjoyed it more when I went back to it. I did not, I enjoyed it hugely the first time, but I think you are slightly, as the reviewer said, you are slightly bamboozled by the amount of stuff going on.
So now we're going to do something a bit different. Thanks, John G, very much. Oh,
thank you
for talking to us. What a huge treat. I mean, that's been sorted for years now. Muriel Spark, he will come.
At the beginning, we were talking about David Miller, who, as we said, unfortunately died over Christmas. And when we were preparing for our William Maxwell episode a few weeks ago, I know that David was a huge fan of Maxwell. And I said to him, well, what should I read? Which novel is your favourite? What story should I read? And he said to me, I included a story in That Glimpse of Truth, a very short story called Love, which will take you 5 minutes to read and stay with you forever. And so as a little tribute to David, and because we have connections with Maxwell here on Backlisted, John and I are going to read you to say farewell, Love by William Maxwell. John, shall I read the first half? Okay. Miss Vera Brown. She wrote on the blackboard, letter by letter, in flawlessly oval Palmer method. Our teacher for the fifth grade. The name might as well have been graven in stone. As she called the roll, her voice was as gentle as the expression in her beautiful dark brown eyes. She reminded me of pansies. When she called on Alvin Ahrens to recite and he said, I know, but I can't say. The class snickered, but she said, try, encouragingly, and waited, to be sure that he didn't know the answer, and then said to one of the hands waving in the air, tell Alvin what 1/5 of 3/8 is. If we arrive late to school, red-faced and out of breath and bursting with the excuse we had thought up on the way, before we could speak, she said, I'm sure you couldn't help it. Close the door, please, and take your seat. If she kept us after school, it was not to scold us, but to help us pass the hard part. Somebody left a big red apple on her desk for her to find when she came into the classroom, and she smiled and put it in her desk out of sight. Somebody else left some purple asters, which she put in her drinking glass. After that, the presents kept coming. She was the only pretty teacher in the school. She never had to ask us to be quiet or to stop throwing erasers. We would not have dreamed of doing anything that would displease her. Somebody wormed it out of her when her birthday was, and while she was out of the room, the class voted to present her with flowers from the greenhouse. Then they took another vote, and sweet peas won. When she saw the florist's box waiting on her desk, she said, oh? Look inside, we all said. Her delicate fingers seemed to take forever to remove the ribbon. In the end, she raised the lid of the box and exclaimed, read the card, we shouted. Many happy returns to Miss Vera Brown from the fifth grade, it said. She put her nose in the flowers and said, thank you all very, very much, and then turned our minds to the spelling lesson for the day. After school, we escorted her downtown in a body to a special matinee of D.W. Griffith's Hearts of the World. She was not allowed to buy her ticket. We paid for everything. We meant to have her for our teacher forever. We intended to pass right up through 6th, 7th, and 8th grades and on into high school, taking her with us. But that isn't what happened. One day, there was a substitute teacher. We expected our real teacher to be back the next day, but she wasn't. Week after week passed, and the substitute continued to sit at Miss Brown's desk, calling on us to recite and giving out tests and handing them back with grades on them, and we went on acting the way we had when Miss Brown was there, because we didn't want her to come back and find we hadn't been nice to the substitute. One Monday morning, she cleared her throat and said that Miss Brown was sick and not coming back for the rest of the term. In the fall, we had passed on into the 6th grade, and she was still not back. Benny Irish's mother found out that she was living with an aunt and uncle on a farm a mile or so beyond the edge of town. One afternoon after school, Benny and I got on our bikes and rode out to see her. At the place where the road turned off to go to the cemetery and the Chautauqua grounds, there was a red barn with a huge circus poster on it, showing the entire inside of the Sells Floto circus tent and everything that was going on in all three rings. In the summertime, riding in the back seat of my father's open Chalmers, I used to crane my neck as we passed that turn, hoping to see every last tiger and flying trapeze artist, but it was never possible. The poster was weather-beaten now, with loose strips of paper hanging down.
It was getting dark when we wheeled our bikes up the lane of the farmhouse where Miss Brown lived. "You knock," Benny said, as we started on the porch. "No, you do it," I said. We hadn't thought ahead to what it would be like to see her. We wouldn't have been surprised if she'd come to the door herself and thrown up her hands in astonishment when she saw who it was. But instead, a much older woman opened the door and said, "What do you want?" "We came to see Miss Brown," I said. "We're in her class at school," Benny explained. I could see that the woman was trying to decide whether she should tell us to go away, but she said, "I'll find out if she wants to see you," and left us standing on the porch for what seemed like a long time. Then she appeared again and said, "You can come in now." As we followed her through the front parlour, I could make out in the dim light that there was an old-fashioned organ, like the kind you used to see in country churches, and linoleum on the floor, and stiff, uncomfortable chairs, and family portraits behind curved glass in big oval frames. The room beyond it was lighted by a coal oil lamp, but seemed ever so much darker than the unlighted room we'd just passed through. Propped up on pillows in a big double bed was our teacher, but so changed. Her arms were like sticks, and all the life in her seemed concentrated in her eyes, which had dark circles around them and were enormous. She managed a flicker of recognition, but I was struck dumb by the fact that she didn't seem glad to see us. She didn't belong to us anymore. She belonged to her illness. Benny said, "I hope you get well soon." The angel who watches over little boys who know but they can't say it saw to it that we didn't touch anything. And in a minute we were outside on our bicycles, riding through the dusk toward the turn in the road and town. A few weeks later, I read in the Lincoln Evening Courier that Miss Vera Brown, who taught the fifth grade in Central School, had died of tuberculosis, aged 23 years and 7 months. Sometimes I went with my mother when she put flowers on the graves of my grandparents. The cinder roads wound through the cemetery in ways she understood and I didn't, and I would read the names on the monuments: Brower, Cadwallader, Andrews, Bates, Mitchell, in loving memory of, infant daughter of, beloved wife of. The cemetery was so large and so many people were buried there, it would have taken a long time to locate a particular grave if you didn't know where it was already. But I know, the way I sometimes know what it is in wrapped packages, that the elderly woman who let us in and who took care of Miss Brown during her last illness went to the cemetery regularly and poured the rancid water out of the tin receptacle that was sunk below the level of the grass at the foot of her grave and filled it with fresh water from a nearby faucet and arranged the flowers she had brought in such a way as to please the eye of the living and the closed eyes of the dead.
And that's it. Thank you, David.
Thanks, David.
If you prefer to listen to Backlisted without adverts, you can sign up to our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/backlisted. As well as getting the show early, you get a whole 2 extra episodes of what we call Locklisted, which is Andy, me and Nikki talking about the books, music and films we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.